पार्थाय प्रतिबोधिताम् भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतिताम् पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीम् भगवतीम् अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धतानि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणी.
Chapter 4, verse 23.
Gatasangasya muktasya, Gatasangasya muktasya, Jnanavastita chetasaha, Jnanavastita chetasaha, Yajnaya charitakarma, Yajnayacharitakarma samagram padiliyate, samagram padiliyate. Gata sangasya muktasya jnana avastita chetasaha yajnaya acharitaha karma samagram padiliyate. Gata sangasya. Sangha is attachment. Gata, past passive participle, is gone. The one form, bahuvahi compound, gata sangasya, the one for whom attachment is gone. The one who has no attachment, gata sangasya. Who is muktasya, who is liberated. Mukta from much, past passive participle, right? Much pasta mukta. So for the one who is liberated, for whom all of the sangha attachment is gone, jnana avastita chetasaha, whose mind, whose chetas, the mind, buddhi, whose mind, is avastita, abiding, firmly abiding, in jnanam, right? Who has nishta, jnana nishta, the one whose mind is held, stays firmly in one's knowledge. Jnana avastita, sta stita, past passive participle. Jnana avastita chetasaha, so the one whose mind is held, is abiding firmly. Not held. It goes from sta to stand, to remain. So to stay firm, to remain firmly in jnanam, in knowledge. So that, and chetas is genitive, all three genitives. So gatasangasya, muktasya, jnana avastita chetasaha, yajnaya acharitaha. Present participle in the genitive, acharitaha, the one who is performing karma, right? The one who is doing, who is acting, for yajna. Yajna means all of the actions we're getting to. It's really all of the all that you do is for yajna, means all, everything is an offering for Ishvara. But the yajna is a ritual, and everything is then offered to the Lord. And then the gifts of, then what is given after the ritual is your prasadam. So for whom all action is yajna. Yajnaya is in the dative, for the sake of yajna. It means for the sake of Ishvara. Right? This came in a previous verse also, where yajna was used for Ishvara. So all of the all of one's behavior, all actions are done for the sake of, for yajna. For that person, so all of these genitives are describing this person, the mukta, the liberated person. Karma samagram, karma in its entirety, all karma, praviliyate, is resolved. Okay. So now, when we think of, well, I think I'll just, there's different routes we can go, I'm going to take this route. For jiva, we say there's three types of karma, right? There's the prarabdha karma. Those karmas are fructifying now. They're the karmas that caused you to take this birth. They come out of the sanchitta, which is the infinite number of karmas that have yet to fructify. So that are not fructifying yet, but there's a, because the lifetimes are beginningless, there's an infinite amount of sanchitta karmas. But out of those sanchitta karmas, karmas that are appropriate for this particular life have come. Those are called the prarabdha karmas. Those karmas will take you through from birth to death. Right? And then, while you're going through, while you're living your life, that is really the effect of the prarabdha karma, you are accruing karmas. And those karmas, the fresh karmas that you're accruing now, those are called agami karmas. So those karmas actually will go into your sanchitta file to be fructified later.
Yeah.
I call it the file. So now, your account. Now, of these three karmas, the prarabdha karma, the one that are taking, that are fructifying now, those karmas are going to be exhausted at your death. They are what keep you here as a jiva. They've what caused you to take this birth, and they'll take you all the way through until these karmas have exhausted and then this body drops. So that's what is going to be responsible for exhausting the prarabdha karma. It's just the living it out. The exhaustion of the prarabdha karma takes place through living it out. Okay? But now, the sanchitta karmas are infinite in number. There is no way to exhaust those karmas. In other words, if you were to go on life after life after life after life, you would still never exhaust them because it's beginningless. So the sanchitta file is, if you think that you're going to, you know, try to exhaust all of those, you have to forget that. It's not possible. So those karmas are just hanging out there in your account. Now, so there's those that we're going to have to deal with. Then there's also now, in this lifetime, the agami karmas, karmas that you're collecting. Right? So in this verse it says, for the jivanmukta, who is free of all attachment, whose mind is resting in knowledge, and who performs all karma for this Purishwara, for as yajna, as ritual, as one would do a ritual, all karmas are done in that attitude. For that person, karma samagram, all karma, is resolved. How can all karma be resolved? Sanchitta karmas are infinite, right? The prarabdha karma, you have to live it out. And here I am as a jiva doing karmas, accruing more karmas. How can I be resolved of all of them? Only in the understanding of myself as a karta. In other words, the jnani, the one who has self-knowledge, what is the self-knowledge about myself? What do I recognize about myself as Brahman? I recognize that the Atma is akarta. The self has never, in fact, done any karma whatsoever and is not going to be doing any karma. Has not done karma, is not doing karma now, will never do karma. The self is free of karma. But in order for that to be meaningful to me, my mind has to be living that reality and not living the mitya reality. In other words, let me explain. If I am getha sangasya, if I am a person for whom there isn't any attachment, right? By not being any attachment means that it's not that I don't have preferences, but if one of my preferences doesn't pan out, I'm still fine. I can let it go. Gata sangasya is vairagya. I have vairagya. Vairagya is not a negative state. Dispassion is not a negative state. It means that I can be present with what is actually happening, moment to moment to moment to moment. And what is actually happening sometimes is good, sometimes is bad, sometimes is my preference, sometimes is not my preference. But my preference does not weigh in heavily on me because I don't feel that, this is talking from the standpoint of jnanam, I don't feel that my ananda isn't at stake by my preference not being fulfilled. And so I'm not asking Ishwara, or I'm not asking the universe to take care of me in terms of my ananda. Right? I'm not asking the universe to kind of service me in terms of keeping me happy or behaving in such a way that I will be at peace. I'm rather depend upon the Atma, my own being, for that ananda or for that peace or for that stability. So that the mind that is dependent on the self for the stability and for the well-being and the peace, then that mind is free to enjoy the creation as it is, to participate in the creation as it is, to take things as they come. So that's the gatasangasya. And that's the mukta also, the one who is liberated because of that. You're liberated because of knowledge. But until the knowledge, until that nishta is there, which he's now saying, jnana avastita chetasaha, for the mind that is rooted in that knowledge. For that person, because I'm not requiring the creation to be in a particular way, because I'm not attached to it to be in a particular way, and the only reason I'm not attached to it being in a particular way is because my ananda is not superimposed on it. If your ananda is superimposed, your well-being, your happiness is superimposed on the creation, then I need this to be happy because my ananda is out there. And this is what happens until we gain nishta. The ananda, the well-being, the happiness, the peace, keeps creeping out onto the creation. You know, where I see if the creation is like this, I will be at peace. If the creation is like this, I will be happy. If you are behaving like this, I will be happy. You know, if my family is in order in this way, I will be happy. And so these are conditions. As soon as these conditions are there, then I'm a karta. Right? Because that ajnanam forces the kartvatvam, the doership, on me. Because if I take the ananda to be out here, then I have to go out here and find it. That ananda is myself. It's as though I see myself out there and I have to go rescue me. Because it's not all right for me not to have myself. It's what it amounts to. So it's not all right for me to not be whole or not to be complete. That goes against my nature, right? And so, now, for jnani, for one who's gaining nishta, when the ananda seeps out onto the creation and you find your mind running out after it, then for the one who has knowledge, the buddhi, has a strong buddhi, I mean, buddhi means your knowledge is strong, then what happens is that buddhi understands that mind that's running, habitually running out. And it simply goes out and grabs it and brings it nicely home. Because it understands. It understands it itself, your buddhi itself, is abiding with you. Your buddhi itself enjoys your own being for its ananda. That is its home base. It understands all of this as Ishvara. And it also understands the problem of habitual thinking, of habit, of emotions, of samskaras. It understands all of that. And so when the buddhi is well educated, not only in this vision, but in this vision, the psychological aspects of this vision, when the buddhi is educated, then what happens is, whenever the mind is going out in order to regain my happiness, the buddhi can bring it back. Bring it back how? Just with knowledge. And why would it bother? Why would it bother to bring it back? It's only because normally when you are going out to find your happiness, at that moment you're not happy. Right? If I see, look at how it works. Normally you can say, okay, everything is fine, all is well with me. When all is well with me, then the creation that you're experiencing is fine, and you are engaged in it, and you do what is necessary, and you're helpful and whatnot. No problem. You're just simply living simply. When you have a desire, when a desire comes that says, I need this to be happy, now in this rather, what was a peaceful state, right, now gains a moment of tension. Right? Because all of a sudden things aren't all right. They aren't all right the way they are. Because now I need this in order to be happy. And this happens in so many subtle levels. Often it has, especially in relationships, is I need you to be like this in order to be happy. You know? So it's so many, always often involved in people. You know? Doesn't usually involve our dog or our cat or child. You know, children can cause a lot of stress. Tremendous amount of stress. You know, but it's where these areas where the stress is caused, I need you to be like this so that I can be happy. Or I need to have this money in the bank account in order for me to be happy. It's at these times, you know, that stress is coming. And so it's at these times that I can bring my knowledge naturally comes, you know, and brings me back to myself and lets me look at the world as Ishwara. So when I'm looking at the world as Ishwara and recognizing that it is my being, when I'm enjoying that knowledge, when I'm reveling in that knowledge, or just taking that knowledge for granted, which is true, for example, you take that knowledge for granted until it's disturbed. Right? And once you have knowledge, just like for an Ajnani, you don't walk around saying, you know, I'm the body, please don't forget. I'm the body, 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 I'm the body. You don't need to remind yourself. Right? That you have nishta. You have I am the body nishta, jnana nishta in that, in what we call mitya jnanam. And so you don't have to keep telling yourself. For jnani also, once that viveka is there, once you've differentiated, once you've recognized yourself, once you can look out at the creation and see really there's nothing but satchit here, nama rupa. The satchit of your being and nama-rupa. Once that knowledge is firm, you don't need to walk around saying, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, I am Brahman. Unless you're behaving like you're not. The moment you behave like you're not, you go, what? And then, because it's painful, right? It's painful. Then you have to bring your mind back. And when you bring your mind back and realize who you are and what the source of ananda is, and what your place is in this creation, right? All of the things smooth out again, and then what do you find? Then you're now engaging in and responding to the creation, which is here in front of you to be responded to. Like I was realizing, I don't know that I've quite said it this way. I've talked a little bit about it, but. For jnani, if your mind is relaxed in yourself and relaxed in the creation, the main vritti, if there's something for you to do, it's more in regards to how can I help? How can I be useful in the situation? How can I be useful? What's there for me to do? How can I help? Because your ananda is not at stake. You're not trying to squeeze some ananda out of the situation. The ananda is already there. And so then the question is, you know, what's there for me to do here? How can I be useful? Okay. Now, if your mind, so that's, I think that's something that we can appreciate. It's a beautiful sadhana. That you just think in a situation, how can I be useful? And that gives you a proper attitude. You know, it gives you an attitude of love, of compassion, of care, of helping, of ahimsa. It's very helpful and easy to do. Now what happens is what if somebody in the situation, because remember the problem is usually people, somebody in the situation that you would like to be helpful is just being a jerk, being very difficult, being angry at you or causing you pain, you know. Coming into a kind of a harsh relationship with you. So causing you sorrow, causing you pain. Doing things that are not making your life easy at all. They're difficult. Yeah. And then you would like to just be able to feel, how can I help? You know? But it's, how can I help you? You know, how can I help in this situation? But that nice feeling doesn't come. What comes is what's more natural to come in that situation is You know, you are really making me miserable, and I wish you would just go away. Just go. Whatever form your annoyance takes, you know. Whatever form it takes, all are fine. Okay, so no. That's not the point. The form of the annoyance is not the point. What you can try saying that I personally have found to be very beautiful, actually, is the how can I help in the situation probably doesn't come very naturally. You know? So you say to yourself, how can I help you in this situation? And that does help. Right? Instead of, because you're not ready, you're the one that's being hurt by the situation, so you're not in a very helpful frame of mind, you know? And to try to be helpful is kind of phony, you know? But the one who needs help in your sphere at this time is you. And so let your buddhi at that time say, okay, how can I help you? And then the part that's hurt and having a hard time in the situation will relax and has an ally. It has an ally now, somebody who cares. And then you can come back to your own shanti. Then that part that's hurt will allow you to come back to your own shanti. You know? So this is a simple thing, right? But it's very, very effective. And so I call these are the things, these are the little tricks of the trade, you know, that we call kaushalam. It's the things that you learn how to be with your mind. And it's all jnanam, it's all based upon your knowledge. But you learn how to handle not only the world out here, but there's a huge world in here that needs to be handled, it needs to be cared for, it needs to be spoken to correctly. Correctly means what? In a way that is helpful. Helpful for what? Helpful for its maturing. Helpful for its own peace. For its own shanti. For its own feeling of that all is well with me. You know? And so you can't bypass the one who is inside hurt to be helpful to the ones outside. If there's somebody inside who needs attention, you know, it's just like in the plains where they say, before you put on the mask for your child, put on your mask first, right? Put on your mask first, because then you'll be in the right disposition, you know, to be able to help your child and everybody around you. So put on your mask first. But here it is also true. You have to put on your mask first, because otherwise what is happening is what? The person who is hurt, it is that hurt or angry person that is now communicating with the world. And so that's like a virus. It's very contagious. Your state of being is something that is everybody participates in. It's very interesting. We all participate in each other's state of being, right? And so if I'm very cranky or unhappy, then everybody around me is going to have to kind of suffer that, and they'll all leave as quickly as they can. That's what we do, you know. We just kind of exit quickly. So say if you're cranky or in a bad mood or all of that, just especially, and we've talked, this is so true in therapy with our clients. But when somebody's really in a bad mood and hurting and feeling and down and angry and depressed, that's the time when you really need people to come and help you and pat you on the back. And that's usually the time that everybody's heading for the hills. But what has to happen, though, what has to happen is that you yourself have to know how to do that. Yeah. And that needs to, it doesn't need to, but it's so helpful if that becomes natural, that how can I help turns inward when there's a problem inside. And then that allows for that shanti. All of this type of attitude is all part of jnanam, really. You know, it's all kaushalam. It's how to be externally and internally with my knowledge. And not just looking as though knowledge is directed outward. In fact, everything is outward from the Atma. Right? In the sense, everything is the Maya Upadhi. Every single part of the creation, including my mind and sense organs and moods and emotions and the Ahankara and the whole physical body in this creation, all of it is Ishvara. Right? And so the buddhi needs to have that jnana drishti, that jnanam, has to be directed toward the entire upadhi, which includes the whole physical creation, which includes my body, which includes the mind and the sense organs and the moods and the emotions and the ahankara. The buddhi needs to handle it all with its knowledge and have a certain freedom. That freedom is ahimsa, it's kindness. The freedom is the recognition that I am Brahman. But then freedom, the mind's, the buddhi's freedom from pain, right? From habitual pain or responding to the creation in a way that creates pain. You know, that's kaushalam. That's learning some of these tricks of the trade. And one that's very useful is just this simple, how can I be helped? How can I be helpful? And if that kind of response is not naturally coming to me in a given situation, then I need to turn it inward. It's kind of like saying, how can I help you? So how can I help you, little one inside? How can I help you so that you can be helpful? How can I help you? What is it? And so taking the inner as seriously as the outer in terms of antakarna shuddhi, the buddhi can do that, include the whole upadhi, right, in its purview of knowledge. Then this antakarna shuddhi, this relaxation of mind comes. Now, with that antakarna shuddhi that comes from all of this gatasangasya, you know, from the Gata Sangha, this freedom from attachment, and have mind that's abiding in knowledge, that antakarna shuddhi comes. What do I recognize? How do I recognize myself for the jnani? How do I recognize myself as Brahman, as Atma, as Akarta? Now, if I recognize myself as Akarta, then all of the activities that are taking place in me, right, are in no way changing me. In fact, I'm not doing anything. If I'm not doing anything and I am not engaged in the world asking it to do anything for me, then the kartrut tvam is gone for me. It's just totally resolved. Because I'm appreciating Ishwara as is, appreciating myself as is, and my engagement in the creation is just that of yajna. In other words, everything is for the sake of Ishvara. Everything is for the sake of the Lord. It's not so that I can be happy. And that is not a sacrifice. See, knowledge is not making you into some sort of sacrificial lamb. You know? Where you say, I only do things for Ishvara, I do nothing for me. That's kartrut tvam, right? As though you're sacrificing your happiness. You do everything for Ishvara, you do nothing for yourself. I do nothing, you know, I do nothing for my own well-being. I do nothing to make myself happy. Everything I do is for Ishvara. That's the great samsari. Right? Here, everything you do is for Ishvara, not for yourself, because you are all of this. And the ananda that you've sought when you were an ajnani, you've recognized as your own being. And so you're not doing things in order to be happy, because the mind has already solved that riddle. Knowledge has already solved that riddle. So the source of happiness is your own being. So the mind resting in your being appreciates Ishvara, appreciates this prarabdha, isn't seeking to become happy because you've already found the source of ananda. Right? The mind has discovered the source of ananda. And so you're not seeking that out of the world anymore. And so then what are you doing in the world? Because here you are. You have a body, mind, sense organs. You're doing. You're engaging in action. How are you engaging in the action? You see it all as Ishvara. Everything you do is really just for the sake of Ishvara. In fact, everything you do is Ishvara. And that is what is understood. And so for that person, there is no karma. There's no karta. There's no karma. I'm not doing anything in order to gain a given result or gain my happiness. So the do, I see the doer, the doing, and the karma, all of it as just being Ishvara. And so for such a person, there is no more karma. All karma for you is resolved. The sanchitta karma is completely resolved. Why? Because I'm not a karta. If I'm not a karta, if I'm not a doer, then there's no karma for me. The prarabdha karma is completely resolved because it's already manifesting, and as it manifests, I recognize I am a karta. Right? As it's manifesting, and it will exhaust itself completely in the end, but as it manifests, I realize I am a karta. For the agami karmas that are coming, the things that I'm doing, I do all of those in the spirit of yajna. Why? Because I am a karta. And that is my self-experience of myself. It's not as though I'm thinking, they tell me I'm a karta. That's like a belief. This isn't a belief. This is that you've recognized the changelessness of your being. That as all of this activity is taking place, you are simply abiding as the conscious being that you are without any type of change or becoming. And so for you, there is no karma. And there never has been any karma. There never will be any karma. That karma is completely resolved. But that is the state of a jnani. So now, he wants to do this. We're going to do this famous verse where absolutely everything is looked at as Brahman. Not just that you're a karta, that there's no karta, but that absolutely everything is Brahman. This is the prayer that we always chant before eating, before meal. Brahmarpanam brahmahavihi, brahmarpanam brahmahavihi, brahmagnau brahmanahutam, brahmagnau brahmanahutam, brahmaivatenagantavyam, brahmaivatenagantavyam. Brahma karma samadhina, Brahma karma samadhina, Brahmarpanam brahmahavihi, Brahmagnau brahmanahutam, Brahmagnau brahmanahutam, Brahmaivatena gantavyam, Brahmaivatena gantavyam, Brahma karma samadhina. Brahma karma samadhina. Brahma arpanam. Brahma havihi. Brahma agnau. Brahmana hutam. Brahma eva tena gantavyam. Brahma eva tena gantavyam. Brahma karma samadhina. Brahma, Brahman, is the arpanam. The arpana in a ritual, the arpanam is the ladle that's used to do the to offer the ghee, offer the offering. It's also the mantra. The arpana is also the mantra that will accompany the offering. So either way, that which accompanies the offering is in the form of a mantra, or the instrument or ladle that's used to make the offering. So both are the arpanam. So Brahma is the arpana, it's the instrument. Brahma is the havihi, is the offering itself. So Brahman is the instrument, or the mantra. Brahman is the offering, the havas, that which is actually being offered into the fire. Brahman is the havas. Brahma is the agni, is the fire. Into the, so agnau is locative. So into the fire of which is Brahman, so Brahma agnau, so into the fire which is Brahman, Brahmana by Brahman, hutam is offered. So it says, Brahma is the arpanam. Brahma is the offering which is offered by Brahman into the fire which is Brahman. You got to see? Brahma eva tena gantavyam. Brahman alone, gantavyam, is reached, is gained, tena by him. Brahma karma samadhina. By him, by the one, for whom the samadhi, whose mind is absorbed, has totally recognized. Samadhi means sees it only in this way. That the karma, all karma, is Brahman alone. Right? All, everything is Brahman. If you say all karma, all that is, all objects are Brahman alone. So in this verse, you know, this verse kind of brings the whole vision, you know, and they're using the vision. This verse isn't about a ritual, but it's using the ritual as an example of every single part of an act, of an activity to actually be Brahman. So for instance, when we look in Sanskrit in the bhaktis, means in the declensions, right, we have what are called the katakas. The katakas are those parts of speech that relate directly to the verb. So for instance, the karta is the subject of the verb, right? The one who does the ritual is the karta, right? The karma is the object of the verb, right? So in here, in this ritual, the karta is offering. That's the verb, right? Is offering the havis. Havis is the karma, right? That's what's being offered, right? By what? By the arpanam. By the arpana. Arpana is the instrumental case, right? So, but that becomes the instrument. So the karta, the subject, is offering, which is Brahman, is offering the object, the havis, which is Brahman, by means of the arpanam, the ladle or the mantra, which is Brahman, and is doing that offering into the locative case, into the fire, right? And who is doing it? Brahman. So Brahman is offering, right? Brahman is offering Brahman into Brahman by Brahman. Right? So the karta, the karma, the karana, the locative case, all of them are being portrayed here. Right? And these are all of the things that can relate to the verb. And so who is this true for? For the one who sees, for the one whose mind is totally absorbed, samadhi, who totally understands that karma is Brahman. Karma means all that we do, all activity. And every part of activity, subject, object, karma, karta, karma, karana, all parts of activity are only Brahman. And the very place where it is done, where the ritual is done, that is Brahman, right? So all of it. So now, this verse, so of course when you're eating, if you say it as a prayer, all what you're saying is just bringing the entire vision. Everything is Brahman. You know, I am Brahman, the food that I eat is Brahman, putting the food into my mouth is Brahman. Like the whole, the spoon is Brahman. The whole thing is Brahman. And so this is really, I am the whole. This is the vision, in fact. And so then how do we really hold this vision, you know? What is our experience of this vision just on a daily basis? In the previous, when we were doing Panchadashi, they touched on this a little bit last week. So I'm going to touch on this again. There there's the teaching methodology involves this drik drisha viveka. Often the teaching will start with a drik drisha viveka. Because this is what has to be seen when you're looking out at the world through your eyes. Your eyes and your sense organs are always, with or without knowledge, are always going to give you the experience of the creation, whether jnani or ajnani. If you're looking with your eyes, you're going to see whatever is there in front of you to be seen. Equally, both see it. Right? So the sense organs will allow you and give you the full experience of duality. But what the sense organs are not able to give you is the recognition of your own presence, which is the substrate being of this duality that you're experiencing. And in order to be able to recognize your pervasive presence, the pervasive presence of your being in this world that you're experiencing, right? To recognize the sat-chit, right, of the world that you're experiencing, you first need to be able to differentiate that sat-chit, the conscious, awareful being that you are. You need to be able to differentiate that presence of yourself from this body, mind, sense organs. Because if your presence, the me, your sense of me, is totally one with this physical body, right? So I am this. Then there's no way that this amness that I am can be recognized as the being of all name and form that we experience. See what I mean? If the very personal me belongs only to this body, which it does for an ajnani, it belongs to the body, mind, sense organs. That sense of me and the body are so inextricable. I mean, they're so united. They are only one thing, and it is a huge, huge job to differentiate between these two, because you would never believe that what makes you you, your own personal sense of you, is so identified with the way you look as a physical being that you think that, will often think that what the Vedanta has to say in terms of yourself as Brahman is something else for you to discover. Mm-hmm. It's like a sense of self that you've somehow missed in your experience, something for you to be shown or directed to. We would never believe that the Brahman that is being talked about is this very personal me that right now, at this moment, I take to be this physical body. And that personal me can't be the me which is pervasive to the creation. So until that viveka, until we do that viveka, you know, it's very difficult to release that self, even though once we do make a crack in that very firm identification, what you realize is that, in fact, absolutely everything in your experience, there is nothing in your experience that has any distance at all from the conscious being that you are. Nothing. In other words, if I think right now, very simply, what I'm perceiving in my mind, I'm having a vritti, a thought modification of this room. I am aware of it. I am present to the entire thought modification. The whole thought modification equally enjoys my awareness, right? It equally enjoys my awareness, not partially. And in this thought modification, there's time and there's space and there's objectivity and there's many bodies, not just mine. And there's inert things too, like the lamp or like the rug. And so I have to have liberated myself from the physical ownership of this body, as though this body physically owns my presence, in order to realize that this me that is so personal is the me in which all is the me of all things. But when you think about it, it's why we use certain things like the dream analogy or the imagination, because if you use the dream analogy or imagination or any of these things, it becomes so obvious. It becomes what this verse is saying. You know? Like, for instance, if you were to see if I were to paint a picture of a dream, and in the dream you are performing a ritual, right? You're performing a ritual. It's a beautiful fire ritual. And you are actually offering ghee into the fire as you chant. Right? And I could say, as a dream, you know, you are the bricks and you are the fire. Right? You're the bricks and you're the fire. And you're the arpanum. And you're the offering, and you are the chanting. Right? And you are the whole ritual, and you are the karmapala. You are the karmapala that the ritual is evoking. There is nothing outside of that. In fact, you are the very ground on which the ritual is placed. Right? And you are the agni, you are the fire, and you're also the smoke, you know, which takes the mantras up to the devatas. And you are also the devatas, right? You're the smoke that's taking the mantra up to the devatas, and you're the devatas who are receiving the mantra, right? And for that, you're also all of the rains that are coming down to bless because of the success of the ritual. So, in fact, there is nothing here that is taking place that is not you. And so for the one who sees this, for that one, everything, absolutely everything that is experienced in light of the karma, karma means the ritual. So the one who sees the entire karma, Brahma Karma Samadhina, the one who sees that entire karma, the entire ritual, the entirety of the action, including the actor, the acting, the acted upon, the instruments of the action, the setting of the action, all of the karakas, all of the things that are involved with supporting the verb. So the one who sees the entire ritual, the entire action, every part of it, from subject to object, as Brahman, what does that person receive from the action? Brahman. The karmapala of the action also is Brahman. Right, so here, so just look at this, the verse is so beautiful. Brahmarpanam. Brahman is the means for doing the action. The ladle, in this case. Brahman is the havis, is what is actually being offered in the ritual. Brahman is the fire into which the havis, which is Brahman, is offered. By who? By Brahman. Okay? For the one who sees this entire ritual as Brahman, what is to be gained by that person? Brahman. That's why in the end it says, Brahma eva tena gantavyam. For such a person who sees the whole and everything that they're doing, from the subject to the object to the means, the person who sees the whole as the whole karma as Brahman, what is that person going to gain from that karma? Brahman. And so for that person, for that jnani, who sees the entire ritual, and the ritual stands for all karma, who sees the ritual itself as karma, as samadhi. Samadhi means they see it completely. There isn't any other part of the mind available for anything else. Samadhi, you know, when you have samadhi, that means the mind is resolved. We use the word nirvikalpa samadhi, savikalpa. It means that the mind is totally resolved into that. So for whom this is the result, the mind is totally resolved into this vision. What is the vision? That the karma, the ritual itself, is Brahman. So, because we're using ritual as the example here. So if you see the ritual itself as Brahman, then what is the karma pala? What is to be achieved is Brahman. So then here, that being so, in our actions, what is to be achieved? Brahman. Who is achieving it? Brahman. By what means is it being achieved? Brahman. And so, in fact, there is nothing being achieved that is not already completely present, which is yourself. And so that is the jnanam. And so that person then that has that nishta, then this whole thing is a wonder. This, the whole creation, which is Ishvara, it's nothing but a wonder. It's Ishvara. You know, and so now it's this manifestation. And this is my part in it. This is my play in it. You know? And in this manifestation, and I am Brahman doing such and such a thing which is Brahman, receiving such a thing as Brahman. There is nothing outside of Brahman. The whole thing is Brahman. And so with that, that gives a tremendous amount of freedom. You know? And I no longer, there's no longer anything to achieve. And so then what am I doing then? And then that we say, what are the actions about for a jnani? It's the loka sangraha. It's to help the people. It's let me be of help. And that's the buddhi, because what else is it going to be? What other buddhi is there? You know. So they say, well, what does a jnani do? Well, you just do what is helpful. Now, as we develop in our antakarna shuddhi, you know, that vision itself is, understanding itself is very helpful. But you have to realize that as you gain nishta in this knowledge, clarity, you gain strength and clarity in this knowledge, there's an emotional lag time in terms of your own psyche, the unconscious and habitual ways of being in the world that cause pain. And that's why the how can I help has to be turned to all of the parts that need help. It's not just this world that needs help or the situation. And I don't mean this, oh, let me help you, dear. It's how can I help? I mean that very benignly. You know, how can I be a useful person in this situation? But also, it needs to be turned, that type of nishta, or strength of objectivity, you know, it needs to be turned toward your own mind. And that's what brings about the antakarna shuddhi. If that is left out, then it's very tough for the mind to mature. Very hard, because the mind has its own smallness or pettiness or bad habits or all, it all comes because of hurt. Hurt when you were younger, or hurt of not getting the things that you thought that you needed, or different hurt feelings in this way or that way, or unfortunate events or traumas of this sort or that. All of these things that we collected prior to knowledge, and especially at a young age, you know. And so those parts in ourselves are there in ourselves as much as they are in other people, right? It's not that you just have them or other people have them and you don't. We all have our hurts, you know. And so that the buddhi, if your buddhi leaves you out of the mix, then that hurt you would just have to continue living with, because nobody's taking care of it. And if it's a lot of it's in the unconscious, and so the adult population, say you're an adult, but there's a lot of child traumas and whatnot in the unconscious, the adults that you're with don't see that. They just see the adult you. And they're discussing and talking and engaging with the adult you. They don't understand. They don't know how to talk to the younger parts inside or the more wounded parts inside. They don't know how to take care of those parts. They don't even know about it. Most people don't know about it anyway, period. You know, but now at least you should know about that and be able to turn a kind heart, you know, toward those parts of yourself that are trying to mature and grow and get themselves into trouble. And, you know, you get into trouble with this reaction or that reaction or, you know, behaving in ways that cause bad reactions and, you know, just a mess. You know, but instead of being critical of that mess, you can say, okay, how can I help? How can I help you? And then let that part talk to you. What do you really need? How can I help you? Be a friend. And then you'll watch. The more that becomes habitual to you, the more you'll watch your mind start to unwind. And as it unwinds, then it's more available to be able to handle the ups and downs of the creation. Another thing that's helpful is that in this creation, taking this birth on this loka, the Shastra says it's 50-50. It's not Swargaloka. It's 50-50 Punyapapa. That means that there will be difficult events for all of us. You know, every single person has their different crosses to bear. You know? And so that how can I help, how can I, you know, be a friend inward and outward is a necessary thing. Not thinking that life is easy. Life isn't easy. You know? But then you can kind of understand that about this particular loka. It's not easy, but it's a very good for sadhana. If you think you're just in Swargaloka and you get everything you want, is it, you think of it? Ah, it's there. Somebody's causing you problems? Gone. I said, if somebody's causing you problems? Gone. I don't even want to think about it. That's gone too, okay. Swargaloka. No conflict, no problem. Everything just as you would love it to be. Okay? This isn't Swargaloka. This is Bhuloka. This is the loka, though, where you can gain moksha. You know, this is a very, very special loka. Because in this loka, you can gain moksha. And the world itself is your sadhana. That's why if something is removing your shanti, that's sadhana, immediately. Immediately, as soon as you're discombobulated in one way or another, then that's where you can bring in this, bring in your knowledge and bring in, okay, how can I help? And if you're mad at the people out here, then you're not going to be very helpful to them. So, because that attitude is not helpful, right? If you're angry, then those people will just run away. Okay, so then the how can I help is not necessarily immediately useful to them. It's very useful to you. You know, how can I help? How can I help with this pain, with this problem? And then your psyche will start loving you. It'll love you because you become its best friend. It's a very wonderful thing. You can be the very best friend to your own psyche. And then the psyche, it's amazing. It starts relaxing. Because it knows it has Swamiji is called, he has a friend, philosopher, and guide inside. Uh-huh. You know? You're a friend. You're also a philosopher in the sense that you have knowledge. You can bring your knowledge to play. And you can guide it. You can mentor it in a helpful way. And that's what brings about this antakarana shuddhi. So that peace of mind. And then that peace of mind is really the pala for this knowledge. You know, the tremendous shanti the well-being that's brought about. That's a great pala of that knowledge. Primary pala is moksha. In fact, the primary pala is Brahman. And that shanti is Brahman too. But so is the ashanti. But it's very, very, very nice to have a mind that is taken care of by the buddhi. The mind itself is taken care of by the buddhi, which has jnana-nishtha. So that jnana-nishtha, the mind doesn't have to be perfect. It still has its little problems and complexes and this and that. But the buddhi gains jnana-nishtha way before the mind matures to catch up with it. And that buddhi that has jnana-nishtha, if it doesn't exclude you, the manas, the mind, then this mind benefits from it tremendously. You know, see? It's very, so simple, really. But we have to get it. You know, it makes a big difference in your life. So let's do this verse again for my opening. So it's a verse you have to memorize. Brahmarpanam Brahmahavihi Brahmarpanam Brahmahavihi Brahmagnau Brahmanahutam Brahmaivatena Gantavyam Brahmakarma Samatina Brahmarpanam Brahmahavihi Brahmagnau Brahmanahutam Brahmaivatena Gantavyam Brahmakarma Samatina Harihi. Let's take a minute. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
So I feel like a big question. I'm going to try to really make it simple, but all this that I'm hearing is such a relief, and yet there's something underneath that seems, if I could address that, then I could get there. And that's like just not liking the whole thing, you know, like. It's just like, it's just a mess, you know. I mean, I'm coming back, you know, having to start a life. It's not fun. And just like, God, I just don't want to do it. I just don't want to enter the creation. I don't want to be part of it. I just want to get out. And, you know, then once in a while, like, as you're teaching, I can see, oh, you know, it's a wonder. It's a, you know, then I can have, like, a love for it. In spite of how difficult it is. And how do you get there? You know?
Yeah.
And then I can say, okay, if I can at the root level accept it, then I can have this attitude of I can help. You know.
That's kind of what I'm talking about in a sense, is when I want it to be different, you know, then it's kind of hard to say, what a wonder. You know, because actually it's not being very wonderful to me at the moment, because I really want it to be different, you know, because I feel it's too hard, and, you know, things aren't happening for me in the way that I want, at the speed that I want, so I have certain expectations. You know, and it's just not working out smoothly. It's a rocky road. And so it's painful, and I'm unhappy. And so at that time, it's when you're in the midst of that type of those feelings, right, then that's when we have to go inside and talk to the part inside and kind of bring yourself back, relax your own self. You know, bring your knowledge back to yourself and try to talk to the one who's really frantic, or a feeling that, you know, things are, I'm going to be left in the gutter, or you know, or left with nothing. Nobody's going to help me. Nobody's going to take care of me. All of these fears, whatever. And I'm not trying to put the fears into your head, but just whatever they are. You know, that person needs to be talked to and listened to. You know,
but that's where the challenge is, because sometimes those fears or the doubts, they're not articulated very well. You don't know what to say. You know there's something that's not quite well there, but it doesn't voice itself in a way that you can just address.
Except that's what I would like you to start working with. That actually, if you can address inside, you can learn how to talk to yourself and say, "Stop." It's like talking directly to your unconscious. And just saying, what is it that's really bothering me? What am I really worried about? What am I afraid of? You know? And actually letting your unconscious speak to you and tell you. Or let your conscious mind tell you. You have to ask it and then let it honestly tell you what is bothering you. You know? And then you can, once it you've listened to it all and gotten it all out, then you can maybe bring in some knowledge and some attitudes that will be helpful. But you can't bring in attitudes or knowledge without listening to what the problem is. You know, and sometimes the problem's just a lot of insecurity and feeling, you know, I'm not loved and nobody's going to take care of me. Nobody, you know, really wants me, and there's no place for me in the universe. You know, there's all kinds of childhood complexes that come up in everything, like I'm not going to be taken care of. You know, there's no place for me in the universe. Bhagavan has a plan for everybody else, but not for me. You know, that somehow everybody else has prarabdha that takes them through their whole life. But Bhagavan forgot about me. And he forgot to give me prarabdha that takes me through my whole life.
Or how about the prarabdha is not what you want? I mean, it's like, uh-oh, is that going to be my prarabdha? You know,
but you know what? That is also a common fear. That I'm not going to like my prarabdha. That prarabdha is going to go against who I am. Now, I actually don't think that that's true. And that's different from saying, though, that your prarabdha is swargaloka-like. In other words, everybody's prarabdha has hard parts in it. Definitely. For all of us. There's no exception. There's hard parts in the prarabdha. But the thing is that those hard parts are yours. They are part of your prarabdha. And they're a movement, you know, from A to B to C to D, that you have to go through, right? It's not foreign to you. And so part of it is bringing in that kind of knowledge that allows you to be able to say, even if you can't relax into it, you can kind of learn how to see, to at least bring your knowledge to bear in terms of, you know, this being my prarabdha, and it'll be my prarabdha, will take me all the way through. And you can practice. See, that's an understanding that you have to bring to your experience. And then you can kind of practice that understanding. You can practice it to see that it's true, you know? Like, for instance, you can say, well, I have a really hard time right now, and I don't know, is it going to continue this way for the rest of my life? Is this hard spell going to just get worse and worse and worse and worse, and finally I'm just in the gutter with nothing? Yeah, probably not, you know. I doubt it. You know, but then try to slow everything down. And then go back a couple of months, and then just look at the course of events and look at how they're going, you know. And you can see a little bit into the future. And look at it with an attitude of interest. How is Bhagavan going to resolve this situation? Right? Because you have to end up somewhere. Right?
But what about this? I think it's very helpful, and I think at the core it could be just insecurity about my lot, karma pala, and all this Ishvara there for me. But there's another side that seems like it's a confusion of knowledge. It's a distortion of the knowledge where it's like just like a renunciate. I'm just ready to go. Just ready to go, you know? I mean, there's something
ready to go what?
About that. I just don't have any interest. Well, you know, so if there's a difficult time, then there will be a good time, but so what, you know? Well, I don't really want that good time. In perspective, the bad time
but
is
then,
the time
then how do you spend your time? Well, how can I help?
Yeah, but it's still like if there's a core thing about... I think that I somehow came to the conclusion that this renunciate perspective was good. But then that becomes bad because then I don't want to do anything. Don't want to join.
No, but that's not really a renunciate perspective. You know, because a renunciate perspective is not... resistant or non-resistant. It's participating in your prarabdha as yajna. You know, like in the previous verse that we just did, the one for who's doing everything that they're doing is done really as a yajna. You know, and then the next verse was the karma brahmarpanam, right? So everything is done just as for Ishvara. There's not that there's a big thing for you to be gained from it, but there's nothing to be gained. Well, let's look at it like this. This creation, from a jnana standpoint, when there's no complexes and things getting in the way, the presence of the creation is fine, the absence of the creation is fine. The presence of the creation isn't hurting you. It's Ishvara, it's an infinite manifestation. Right, so to not be willing to engage in my prarabdha, that's an action, that's a karma. I'm not going to be engaged in my prarabdha. Why? Why not? What's wrong with it? You see what I mean? So to have a resistance to say, well, I don't want this, that means I want this, you know? But this is what you've got. And moment after moment, this is what you've got. Mm-hmm. Right? And so you can reject it all, but then what? You're rejecting what you've got.
Well, I just think, you know, I could just walk out in the desert and keep walking. You know, if no opportunities come, just walk. You know, like a renunciate. Just see what happens.
Well, if that's your karma, but you know, and that's an interesting thing. Like in India, sometimes how it used to be, with some of the brahmacharis would come to the guru, to the teacher, up in Rishikesh, okay, and he'd say, "All right, you walk down to Madras, south tip of India, and come back, and when you come back, then I'll teach you. Just go on a long walk. Why? What was the idea? So that you can see." You know, that Ishwara is your, Ishwara will take care of you. So you can, because they went with nothing, just a little commando. Not, they don't take no money, nothing, don't take anything. You just walk down to the tip and come back. Huh?
Barefoot.
Mm-hmm. And see what happens.
Wow.
Yeah. I did that once when I was young, when I was, it must have been 18 or 19, and I wanted to see, because I was very kind of spiritually oriented. I wanted to know. I'd read that yoga and the book and things. I wanted to know if Bhagavan would take care of me. And so I left with nothing. I was only 18. That's my excuse. And I walked down to Mexico and hitchhiked and walked. I had nothing at all. Mm-hmm. And I ended up at, right at the border of Mexico, I was walking on this, like, it was all kind of desert. I walked 2 or 3 miles to God knows where, but it turned out there was some little tiny ashram, and I stayed there, just ended up there, and I stayed there for a few days. And then I walked back and got rides and whatnot and made it back. But it was all for the sake of Shraddha. Are you there or not? Will I be taken care of or not?
This is a test.
This is a test. Yeah. This is a test. It worked. It was fine. It was very, very meaningful for me. You know?
Were you frightened? Or were you?
No, I was too young to be frightened. Yeah. It's before the, those kind of, you know, 60s also. That era, you know, it was a much different era. Mm-hmm. You know, but so that was kind of this is a test. But you can, after a while, you don't need those tests anymore. It's more you become interested in how Ishwara is taking care of you and kind of relaxing into that. You know, and doing your best. Like with Swamiji, these things he said to me, they just, they're imprinted in my mind. Like when he says, I just do my best with what's in front of me. I do my very best with what's here. And that's what he does. And he has so huge, huge, unbelievably complex things going on, coming at him from all directions, so much responsibility, so many hundreds and hundreds of people depended on him, and he doesn't have anything. You know, I mean, Ishwara has to take care of it. Or Ishwara has to take care of it, or the whole thing will collapse, and then that's what Ishwara is doing. And so Swamiji can't take that type of doership or control. You know, he just has to do what's in front of him in the best way that he can, make the, you know, with what happens. And we have to live our, if we live our life like that, things become a lot easier. This is my life. This is what I'm confronted with now. Let me do the best that I can in it. Realizing all of the time, you know, that it's Ishwara's play. That kind of helps. You know, it's like you let everything be a manifestation of your knowledge, or let everything be a sadhana for you. And that's what helps to get through these times that are confusing.
Mm-hmm. It's like a confusion of knowledge.
Yeah.
It's like confusing disinterest with taking an interest in Ishwara's prarabdha for me, you know.
But the disinterest is a kind of depression or anger.
Right, yeah.
It's not really
defiance.
Defiance. All that. It's mixed in with all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah.
Well, that's where the talking has to take place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you know, if they say, like, desires are vibhuti, you know, like, and sometimes, like, that's, you should pay attention because maybe that's your prarabdha coming up in that form. But then, you know, if your desire, say mine, is like not to work, you know, but, and yet it doesn't seem that that would really fit in too well to the plan of Ishwara, you know, or I mean,
well, you've done pretty well so far.
So far, but seems like, you know, things are changing. So, you know, so that, I mean, I guess you just sort of have to balance that. What's your duty, you know, or do you have a duty here, or, you know, I mean, you might not have
But one of the things that causes people a lot of problems is that we see down the road that something is going to have to happen, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like say you're not working, you only have so much money in your bank account. This money will run out at such and such a date. Then what am I going to do? Okay, so then we start living here. We're here, but this is where we're living, and we have no clue what we're going to be doing at this time. And so because we have no clue, then we start living in a fantasy land that is what we often will call catastrophic thinking. Because what will happen? Well, that time will come, and we'll have no money at all. You know, I will have to get a job, but I can't work. I can't do that, you know. And so I don't see any solution for myself. What's going to happen to me? And that's how we think. You know, we see what's coming and we have no solution for it, and then we worry about it. However, if you look at your life, really, you know, you do have a solution for what's in front of you now. In other words, you have something to do right now, right? And you'll have something to do tomorrow that you need to do, and you'll have something to do the next day that you need to do. And life goes on like that. You have what you need at the moment that you need it. You have what you need when you need it. But our problem is that we can't see around the corner. We can't see into the future. And so we'll have a lot of anxiety around that. And you'll start, I think that in time you start to relax and kind of wonder what Bhagavan's going to be giving, throwing your way. You know?
But that's not to say that we shouldn't plan for that point without anxiety now.
No, what it means, though, is that even the planning for the future, that comes up in the present.
Right.
When it's time to plan for something, then you begin planning for it.
Right.
That's in the present, too, right? And decisions that have to be made, that also comes in the present. But a lot of times we know that we're going to have to make a decision in the future, but it's not time to make that decision yet. But then we're going to worry about that decision all the way up until it's time to make the decision. But when it's time to make the decision, then the decision is usually pretty much there to be made. You know, so you have to be patient. You can't make a decision before it's time to make the decision. You can't take an action before it's time to take that action. You can't see around the corner.
Well, aren't you obligated to worry then?
Part of it is learning.
That's that skill.
Mm-hmm.
But
how to handle instead of worrying, how to handle the situation that's here.
Mm. Right. I remember you saying this quite a while back when I was going to. I'm going to end up in the street. Da da da. You know that stuff. And then you said to me, and it sounds funny, but it's absolutely it was right on. And you said to me, well, by that time, if you're going to be in the street, your psyche will be
ready.
And I thought it was brilliant. You know?
Yeah, if that's yours. Right.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you just something about the first verse when we did it and we said that for a jnani, all the karmas, you know, sanchita karma and, all resolved. Because of the recognition that I'm not a karta. Yeah, I'm a karta. Now, the one who is not a karta is me, is the self who is substrate to the mind of the jnani and the ajnani. And the one for whom there is appearance of karma, and for one who, for whom, you know, there is accretion of action in this birth, and there is those are the minds, whether, you know, that's in the realm of mithya, so those are the minds of the jnani or ajnani equally.
Yeah, but when the body drops, there's no... For the jnani, when the prarabdha karma is exhausted, there is no more karma remaining because the jiva itself is disbanded, you know, and so all karma are completely resolved at that time.
Well, I think that was my question, is that given that the law of cause and effect is within the realm of Nitya.
Yeah.
The one for whom, you know, the one who is an akarta, is the self, you know, in a different order of reality.
Yeah.
It's
but
everyone.
If the jiva, if the, yeah, that's true, of course. But if the jiva, the jivatvam, is a product of ajnanam, of ignorance, there is really no jiva. So the ahankara, all of this is a product of ajnanam.
Mm.
When the ajnanam is removed by knowledge, the prarabdha will keep this body and the structure of the jiva going because it's already in empirical reality. It's already exhausting itself, right? This physical body, mind, sense organs. But the ajnanam has been removed. And so there's no jiva to transmigrate. When this body drops, these karmas are over.
So,
then
so the model maintains, that, or we think, the Shastra says that that really, because jivas, because of ajnanam, when ajnanam goes, then
there are no more
jiva.
What keeps the jiva here is bodhita, what we say. It's, you know, it's sublated. But the jiva is here in that sublated form because the prarabdha karma has already begin fructifying. And so when the karma runs out, there will be no more, there's no more jivatvam. That means you are just the whole, you're Ishvara. Which is who you are. You are Ishvara. You know, don't think you're losing something. You are the whole. That's who you're, that's your nature, is to be the whole.
Does it matter to a jnani whether they're reborn or not? I mean, does it make a difference?
If it makes a difference, you'll be reborn. If it were to make a difference,
right?
Yeah, you would
be. So
that means
you're not a jnani. So that means the answer is that for a jnani's mind, it doesn't matter. The matter of the question of rebirth or not.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant.
Right.
Yeah, it's irrelevant. Because, let me put it this way. This is a little bit tangential, but think about this just to get appreciation who you are. Because we're so, the Dehatma Buddhi is so much. But when you're dreaming, you don't have a anxiety attack when you're not embodied in the dream. Sometimes in the dream, you're just the whole, you're just Ishvara in the dream, right? There's no body, right? Sometimes there's the people doing activities, but you have no identification with them, you're still identified with the whole. Sometimes there's no creatures in the dream, there's just scenery. Sometimes you take a body in the dream. But for none of it, that doesn't, not, neither condition is more or less you, right? Because the truth of it is that you are the whole. And so whatever form you are in is fine, right? Because it is you, you know? So the jiva, having this body, there's a lot of suffering involved in having a human body. You know, there's a suffering and limitation. There's birth and death and loss and disease, and there's a whole slew of things, you know. And so, at some point, it may be irrelevant. There's no reason for you to take a body unless you have something that you want to accomplish. You know, if there's nothing that you want to accomplish, to be or to become, because you already are that, then there's not going to be the vritti, the pravritti, right? When we say there won't be a pravritti to have a body. There's the pravritti of the jiva just to simply be with what is. And when this body drops, what is just myself as Ishvara. Not that all of a sudden the body drops and you say, oh, but I want this and I want that. So if that were to happen, then that jivatvam needs to still have more experiences.
Right. I was going the other way, actually, because normally in India you say, you know, well, oh, I don't want to be reborn.
Yeah.
You know, that is the desire to not be reborn, but then it just seems it's...
But I don't even see, I don't see having that desire to not be reborn unless you know that you are the whole.
Right.
But of course, see in India, it's so different. Because in India, you know you're born with into this belief, this understanding of reincarnation, that it's one birth after another, and this is one of many. And so you say, I want to get off this cycle of rebirth. Whereas in the West, the idea of reincarnation and rebirth and all that is relatively new. and it doesn't go along with Judaism or Christianity or anything like that, so it's not known. So when a Westerner finds out this about rebirth, it, oh, thank goodness. Whereas an Indian will say, oh my God.
A lot better than burning in hell.
Yeah. But for a Westerner, it's, oh, you mean I get another chance.
I might
this is just
it.
One life.
No,
so they don't... They don't think about it in terms of, you know, kind of an endless cycle of birth after birth after birth, and that moksha involves getting off that cycle of reincarnation. That a Westerner won't have that vritti, they would not know about that.
The Indian guy, he doesn't know whether he's going to get a more blissful one or maybe a more painful one. That's, I mean,
yeah, but you know,
chance.
Another thing about the beautiful thing, I think, something about the Indian Dharma is you know that you're going to have another chance, another life, which takes the pressure off of this life. And you also know that you have to live a dharmic life in order to have get a good next birth. Right? So your behavior, your following of Dharma and all of these things are very important. They are. They're important because you get a better next birth, and you want that. You want to improve your situation. So there's a much more real, personal understanding of the importance of Dharma. It's not as theoretical. In the West, it's more theoretical. You know, it's like they say there's a heaven and a hell. You know, but it doesn't have this. Yeah.
It's a superimposition.
Yeah, but it doesn't have the. I don't think it has the same
power.
Personal punishment or reward. In other words, it would be very important to me to live a dharmic life because I will get a better life next time, or at least as good, and not have to suffer. There's no end. And you see it as an individual. That's another thing. You see hell on earth. You see how bad it can be, and, you know, how relatively pleasing it could be. So there is such a thing as getting a, you know, a difficult time here.
But say, what about, you know, like if you're a jnani, I mean, do you have any idea about this? Like that pratibandhika jnana, you know, you have that, maybe of those parts of your mind that aren't all sorted out, and you die. I mean, what do you think?
Oh, if you're, well, what they say is if it's something that can be resolved, you know, in Vidya and Mukti, if those things are not big, they can just be resolved.
As you're dying.
But if they can't be, then you'll take another birth and be born into, this is what Krishna says, you'll be born into the house of yogis, people who already have knowledge. Or if there are certain experiences that you need to fulfill in order to complete yourself, you know. You'll be born into a dharmic family and then reunited with your knowledge. But if you have knowledge and it's only some scars and things, that's not going to matter. Because your knowledge is just dealing with them as it's dealing with everything else.
Mm-hmm. Because also, couldn't there sort of get to be a point, and not to be like disconnected or anything, but where, because everything that is Mithya is Ishwara, so, you know, you can kind of see, like, I'm Brahman, and this mind and this body has some problems, has some difficulties, but Not like you like get skitsy or anything, but it's kind of like...
No, but you see it all as Brahman, but also if you see it all as Brahman, then with what attitude do you hold all of these things?
Right.
And that's where the love or the care or the compassion, which are all natural qualities of a human being that's not in pain.
Right.
You know, love is not being loving or kind or compassionate. That's natural. You're not that way when you're in pain. You know, or somebody's attacking you and taking something from you, then the mind reacts and it behaves in all different kinds of ways. But when you're at peace, then all those beautiful qualities are natural. They're your swarupa, they're your swabhava. You know? And then when you think, you know, like I think I said the other day in the spiritual counseling class that I teach, sometimes I'll go around the room and ask, what are your highest values, or when you're thinking of spiritual values or how you would want to be, and what are the highest values? And all of them revolve around the good qualities, like love and compassion and care for others, and you know, all of that. All of them, always. You know, that's what people aspire to, and we don't live up to it because of ajnanam, really. It's because I need this to be happy, and so-and-so is taking it away from me, and my mind gets upset. And I react and do all kinds of things.
It's brilliant.
Huh?
It's brilliant. I mean, that recognition is brilliant.
Yeah. So then to take the... That's why that, you know, that how can I help doesn't work when I'm in that reaction, but then the one that needs help is me.
And that's also kind of an intermissive opinion is part of Ishwara. So then how can I help? It's like almost, like it's not another, it's just helping, because you're Ishwara too. You know?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Is that what Swamiji means when he says Ishwara is a psychology? Is it a psychology also?
Yes, because psychology also is an order. You appreciate,
that's right,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right. But you know, that's why we learn in learning Vedanta, a lot of it is learning all of this psychology, because the mind, everyone has a mind, and the mind needs to be taken care of in light of this knowledge. Of your own mind as well as other people's. Yeah. I really think that the biggest mistake that we make in terms of antakarana shuddhi is not taking care, not giving that love and care and compassion to the parts inside that are hurting or acting out or in trouble. So that's why that how can I help has to be always turned inward as much as outward. It has to be equal, because this is as much one of the beings in Ishwara as everybody else. It's not any less, not more, not less. It's the same.
And also, like, it's your room.
Yeah. It's your closest sadhana. Yeah.
It's your family.
Yeah. It's with you at all times.
It's your lens. Like your
life,
through what you're seeing.
Yeah. In India, you know, they treat the body as a temple, you know. It's bathed and you put the kumkum on and it is a temple.
Yeah.
It's a temple because Bhagavan, you know, the Atma is Brahman. So it is a temple. So also it's very rare to have this human birth. You think of all of the insects, all of the jivas. Start thinking of all of the insects, all of the mosquitoes, billions and billions of insects and animals and creatures. They're all jivas and plants.
Microbes.
And it goes endlessly. And to get a human birth, what that means. And what a rare thing. And then to have that mumukshutvam, you know, to have a buddhi. And then to have the mumukshutvam and to, you know, gain knowledge is considered just extraordinary, extraordinarily rare.
Microbes don't care about moksha. They don't have these problems.
No, the animals need. They get to be happy.
Yeah.
But how can you
or
know that?
Not,
we can't know
not,
that.
You know.
Sure.
What?
We can't know that.
They'll still suffer. I mean, because birth and death, you know.
It's assumed that, I mean, to the extent that you know how much brain development they have, you can kind of...
But you know, you might...
The extent of emotion or... I mean, it's not... An amoeba is not going to have brain enough to, I'm guessing, to be happy or unhappy.
But whatever the brain mm-hmm. development is, there's still, you know, in the creation, there's still change. The creation is infinite birth and death, right? Infinite. So, infinite change at all times. It's amazing. So, infinite change in the changeless. Yeah. That's what's so amazing, right? So we experience both at the same time. Always the changeless and the changing. And that's the key, really, too. Is to recognize that changeless me.
We need to recognize, yeah. like, the changeless in the changing. Actually, I guess one of it is it recognizing the changeless, not as, I mean, like, within the change, well, sort of in a sense. I mean, like, you know, there. Yes, okay, there's the changing and the changeless. But then the changing has the changeless as its being.
Yeah.
So is it recognizing within the changing, the changeless is there, you know?
Yeah, except, you know, the difference is that the changeless being is not objectifiable.
Right.
Right, so it's just the very ground, the very substance mm-hmm. in which all of this change is taking place. Mm-hmm. The things that are changing have no substance other than the changeless.
Yeah.
Right, but you can still differentiate them because the changeless is coming and going, but the stuff that is its truth is absolutely changeless. But that's not something that you're seeing, right? But that is its self-evident experience. So the self-evident experience of conscious being is taking place and is known because it's self-evident. And it is taking place, it is, and it is known. And not separate from the names and forms that you're perceiving because your eyes are open, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's two, there's the self-evident self that is shining and the ever-changing perceptions that you're having. And both are taking place in the same exact place, right? And so you distinguish both, right? You can discern both. And you don't need to see the Atma, because the Atma is self-evident. You don't need your eyes to see that, because it's self-evident. You need your eyes and sense organs to see the names and forms. But the self-evident self is at the same place as the mitya that you're perceiving.
And you just know that through a vritti, right? And that's the only way you can know anything.
Yes, except you have to remember that's true.
Mm-hmm.
The vritti, because ajnanam has been removed, is that vritti recognizes the mityatva of the vritti and the satyam of the self. Right? But the satyam of the self is its own light, illumining the very vritti that recognizes the satyam and the mitya. Yeah. It was just, see, if somebody were listening in on this, they'd go, these people are out of their minds.
we are. Also.
Oh, so you know what I was thinking? Sunday's our last class until I get back. Maybe we should have satsang, do a guided meditation, and then have some questions. Do you want to do that?
Instead of a class.
Uh-huh. Anybody want that?
Yeah.
I'll do a nice guided meditation. That'll be kind of classy-like. but then maybe we could have some in Chuck and Chaitin and Esther will be here. You can think if there's some discussion, some questions, and we can just you know, go on with it for a while.
Maybe you can ask them questions.
No, you can ask me questions.
Great question, Jake.
But I don't mind you all participating in the answer. No, I wasn't thinking of asking them. I was just mentioning that they would be there. That might be good, you know, to think about some questions that are gnawing at you. And we can do some, get into it in some depth. Also, probably when I'm there, maybe, maybe not, but I'll probably do another couple of satsangs with Swamiji.
Oh, great.
So, if you want to, in this what we do on Sunday, you can see what the interesting questions are. I'll answer to my best of my ability, and then if you have some questions you'd like me to, you know, really push him. I like to get it. Pushing means I'll give a question and then he'll answer, and then I will think of, well, what about this, what about that, and try to expand on the question, make him expand on his answer a little bit. You know, I can do that. So we'll probably have time to do a couple of short songs there. It'll be fun. Should we go? Oh, it's 9:30.